Okay. All right, so I'm on service today, so I'm going to warn you in advance if I get a phone call and I have to interrupt this lecture momentarily for that. Hopefully that will not happen. I've informed my staff, but I'm the attending physician on the leukemia service, so if there's a disaster, I have to be informed. Okay, so we're going to talk about medical oncology and clinical trials today, and hopefully I won't be too decompensated with this. So we're going to talk first about the burden of disease and how that informs our upfront therapy for patients with leukemia or with other cancers, and how we distinguish between cancers that are stageable versus cancers that are body-wide, right? We'll talk about the modes of treatment and what kinds of cancers can be successfully treated with chemotherapeutic approaches versus cancers that need to be treated with local therapies, and the distinction between the biology of those tumors I'll sort of comment parenthetically about. We'll talk about the kind of training that it takes to become a medical oncologist or a hematologist and how that translates into real life experience. And then talk about a little bit developmental therapeutics and testing. So I generally, in terms of the exam, I don't usually test on the first part of this. I usually do my questions, as if those of you who looked at the previous year's exams, I usually do my questions on clinical trials and stages of clinical trials and things like that, because I think that's the easiest to test in this. I have not yet made up my questions, so I can't tell you what's going to be on the exam yet, but we'll talk about it as we go through. As I think about it, maybe I'll find areas that are particularly interesting that I find maybe interesting that might be interesting on the exam. Okay, so oncology is the study of malignant tumors of lethal potential. Okay, so when we talk about cancers, generally the thing that goes along with a cancer diagnosis is that it could potentially cause you really serious problems that might foreshorten your life. By contrast, we think also about things like neoplasms, right? So there are neoplasms, new growths, that are not likely to cause death. So on the spectrum of diseases that I treat, I think about things like acute myelogenous leukemia, which is immediately life-threatening, versus things like myeloproliferative neoplasms, like polycythemia vera or essential thrombocythemia, which are associated in the absence of intervention with a normal life expectancy. Malignancies can arise in any tissue and at any age and spread by direct extension or by hematogenous or lymphatic spread. Okay, so when you start out with a tumor, if it's a blood tumor, by definition your blood is everywhere in your body. So those tumors are not staged the same way that a solid tumor, for example, would be staged. Right? A solid tumor is staged, arises in a particular spot, and is potentially, hopefully, confined to that spot until it reaches the point where it can start traveling either through the blood or through the lymphatic system. Those tumors that arise in particular tissues can spread by direct extension. So if I have a tumor in my skin, it can erode through the basement membrane of my skin into the adjacent tissue that's next to it. This is more common in things like lung cancer or breast cancer. So if I have a breast cancer that arises in a duct within my breast, that breast cancer can invade because it's no longer respecting, right, the normal rules for ductal cells. All of a sudden, it can spread directly into the skin that overlies the breast tumor, right? Into the skin directly. And that can present as ulceration of the skin because, in fact, that now what you have is breast tissue growing in a skin space that's not designed to be there, okay? So when you think about these tumors and where they are, this is how you want to think about them just as a paradigm. Cancer is currently the second leading cause of death in the United States and the third worldwide after heart disease and infections. This is likely to rise, particularly in the United States, with our aging population. So historically, right, median survival for men and women was in the mid-70s. These days, I routinely see patients in their 80s in my clinic. And these are patients who are in good shape. And I think what we're going to see is that the older the population gets, the more frequently we're going to see malignancies, which arise either as a result of exposures to things in life, such as sun or other things, and we'll touch on that in a moment, or as a result of mutations that occur in the germline. Those usually occur in young kids, right? So in terms of lifetime cancer risk, the things that develop cancer most frequently in adults are things like breast and prostate, okay? So these are the tissues that are most subject to cancer in patients, followed by lung and bronchus, and this is directly as a result of cigarette smoking and environmental exposures, followed by colon and rectum. Again, these are epithelia that are exposed to carcinogens, right? So in the lung and in the upper airway, upper aerodigestive tract, for example, cigarette smoking, exposure to toxins is directly exposed to those tissues. That results in carcinogenesis, right? When you don't have smoking, the incidence of lung cancer is very, very much lower. In terms of of colon cancer and GI cancers, again, this is a matter of eating exposure. So we know that people who eat pickled foods, people who eat a lot of burned foods, get exposed to nitrogens, and these are carcinogenic. We know that those are increased those are increasing your risk. Followed by ovarian cancer, uterine cancer in women. Uterine cancer is generally driven by isolated exposure to estrogens, right? Followed by cancers of the bladder. Again, high association with smoking here in cancers of the bladder. Melanoma, again, sun exposure is a potential risk, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and the rest. So we know that some cancers arise as a result of environmental or particular lifestyle choices, exposures, but the biggest cause of cancer worldwide is actually viral infections, okay? We don't know exactly why viral infections cause cancer, but we hypothesize that part of it is due to immune turnover. So when your immune system is attacking the virus, you have increased cellular turnover, and that increased cellular turnover speeds up the copying of the genetic material, which increases the risk of developing malignancy. We know this is true, and we know this is true for hepatitis B virus. We know it's also true for HPV. We know that many head and neck cancers in the United States and all over the world are caused by HPV. HPV can intercalate into the genome, right? It can insert itself into the genome, and in doing so can cause mutations in that fashion also. Epstein-Barr virus likewise can do the same, and HIV is certainly a cause of cancer, both directly as a result of HIV itself, as well as a result of the deficiency in the immune system, which potentially allows for decreased immunosurveillance of pre-malignant conditions and emergence of malignancy in that context. So very frequently in patients who have HIV, you see the emergence of cancers that are driven by viral infections, which under normal circumstances would probably be controlled by the immune system. So higher incidence in patients with HIV, particularly people with very poor CD4 counts, higher incidence of Epstein-Barr virus-driven lymphoma. Primary CNS lymphoma is the classic example. We know that genetics predispose people to cancer, so we are very familiar with BRCA1 and BRCA2, the cancer predisposition syndromes that predispose people to cancers of the breast and of the ovary. It turns out that these are DNA repair defects, okay? These result in DNA repair defects, and that results in increased risk of cancers that are driven by those DNA repair defects. We also see other cancer predisposition syndromes, and the more we understand about cancer, the more we identify these. We know that Fanconi anemia, dyskeratosis congenita, which is a short telomere syndrome. We're now familiar with GATA1 mutations in the germline, increasing people's risk for cancers of the bloodstream, bone marrow failure syndromes, and secondary acute myelogenous leukemias. I have a close friend who's working at the University of Chicago who's identifying more and more people who actually have genetically driven leukemia. I think this is an area that's going to become much more recognized. RB mutations, likewise. We know that chemical carcinogens like tobacco and benzene are significantly increasing patients' risk after exposure for carcinogens, and we know that environmental and industrial carcinogens are a driver of cancer. So here in this region, there's a huge amount of environmental toxins as a result of a lot of industrial revolution changes that went on, and there's a relatively higher rate of cancers throughout the industrial revolution belt in this country. We know that drug-induced cancers can occur, such as secondary neoplasia, so this is true. So if I treat a patient with acute myeloid leukemia with an anthracycline, for example, when I treat them with that anthracycline, there's a risk that that patient might develop either myelodysplasia, a secondary bone marrow failure state, or that they might develop some other cancer as a result of exposure. When young people are treated with radiation for lymphoma or with radiation for breast cancer, these increase the risk of thyroid cancer, lung cancer, and many other squamous cell cancers of the skin. So these things are important. This gives you a sense of the cumulative incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma in patients with hepatitis C. So if you have a very high hepatitis C viral load, that is to say your hepatitis is very active, and presumably your immune system is thus very active, and presumably this is killing some of your hepatocytes, which causes them to turn over more frequently, you have a much higher incidence of secondary hepatocellular cancer. H. pylori, this is a chronic infection that occurs in the stomach. Historically, this was thought to be stress-induced, right? You've got ulcers in the stomach. Ulcers and upper GI bleeding felt to be initially stress-induced. We now know that a majority of actual upper aerodigestive ulcers are driven by H. pylori. And chronic infection with H. pylori increases your risk of gastric cancer, okay? This is one of the reasons why gastric cancer is more frequent in Asia, because they have a higher rate of H. pylori carriage. Genetic susceptibilities, this is looking at cancer rates per 100,000 of population, and what you can see here is a much higher rate of cancers in African-American men compared to white men, compared to women, compared to white women, potentially related to either exposures in the environment, it's men in general. You can see that both men, white men and African-American men have higher rates of cancer. This is thought to be related to the fact that men go out into the world more, right, less than women potentially, and have more the kind of jobs that are exposing them to toxins potentially. Probably also related in some way to genetics of being a man, right? Maybe because you only have one copy of the X, you have one copy of the X, maybe for other reasons, maybe because of testosterone effect, we really don't know. This number is coming down, suggesting that maybe this is partially related to exposures that were happening in the African-American community compared to others. You can see that these are rates of cancer by age 50 in BRCA mutant carriers. You can see here rates of breast cancer compared to genetically normal controls. Breast cancer by age 70, secondary breast cancer by age 70. Okay, again, emphasizing the mechanisms of cancer. Smoking, again, as I mentioned before, a very significant risk factor for lung cancer. So you can see here the number of cigarettes smoked per year compared to the number of lung cancer deaths. This is cigarette consumption. This is lung cancer death in men, right? Follows usually about 10 years. When we talk to patients and we talk about risk of secondary cancers and risk of result of toxicity from smoking, they always ask, well, I quit 2 years ago. How long did it take for my risk of cancer to go back to the population risk? We usually say it takes at least 10 years, and there's probably a tail on that, right? So even patients, if you've never, ever smoked, your risk of cancer is lung cancer is considerably less than if you've smoked any cigarettes. And here we talk about more than 10 cigarettes in a lifetime. You can see here worldwide smoking prevalence for men versus women and the much higher incidence of smoking for men. Although women have tried to catch up, but less now. Hormone replacement therapy was identified using large population studies as being an important risk factor for estrogen-driven tumors. We definitely identified that uterine cancers were significantly increased in patients who received unopposed estrogen. So these days, if you get hormone replacement therapy, you get a combination. You get estrogen plus progesterone, and this decreases the risk of uterine cancer. We also know that estrogen-driven cancers, like cancer of the breast, can occur in patients who receive estrogen replacement therapy of any kind. And you can see here, these are majority ER-positive tumors, right? ER-negative tumors stay stable versus ER-positive tumors, which were increased in the context of estrogen replacement therapy and which fell off after you stopped it. Sun exposure, we know, is a risk factor for cancers. I would say a majority of the time, when you think about sun exposure, we think about cancers of squamous cell or basal cell cancers of the skin. Melanoma is always thought of as being a significant sun-exposed risk factor. In my experience, that's a little bit less the case. I see a lot of patients who have melanomas in unsun-exposed areas. So I recently had a patient who passed away from metastatic melanoma that was on his big toe. Started out as a big tumor on his big toe, so probably not a sun-exposed area. I think this is, I think potentially the risk of melanoma exposure in relationship to sun is perhaps overstated. I would argue that a majority of melanomas are probably genetically driven lesions. So in this case, melanoma, we're saying this is a sun-exposed thing versus H. pylori, which is stomach cancer. Drugs and radiation can induce cancers. So things like exposure to radiotherapy with respect to a relationship to breast cancer. You can see here patients receiving radiation therapy early develop breast cancer very late versus patients who receive alkylating agents. So when we think about alkylating agents, we think about things like Cytoxan, right, which is a standard part of the therapy for breast cancer. Patients will get secondary alkylating-related acute myeloid leukemias or myelodysplastic syndromes with a latency of about 5 to 7 years. This is typical for alkylator exposures versus topoisomerase inhibitor-driven AMLs, which are associated usually with mutations in 11q23. So if you have topoisomerase inhibitor exposure for breast cancer, for example, with daunorubicin for breast cancer, 2 years later, on average, with latency, if you're going to get it, you'll get a secondary AML that's driven by the MLL gene rearrangement almost entirely. You can see here that this is also associated in terms of exposure to patients treated with Hodgkin lymphoma who are treated with radiation. You can see incidence of breast cancer, thyroid cancers, and AML, which fall off over time and which are higher in younger people. So if you have breasts that are growing, if you're 15, 14, 13 years old and you get chest radiation to growing breast tissue, that increases your risk of a later breast cancer, right? Because it's during the time of development. Also true for the thyroid. Okay, so we've talked about things that predispose you to cancer. Very frequently when I treat patients, I don't know what's caused their cancer, okay? And to be honest, when I treat patients with leukemia, unless they've had a prior history of exposure to alkylating agents or chemotherapy for breast cancer or some other malignancy, there's really nothing we could have done to prevent it. And as I say to patients, well, okay, I have this leukemia, you're telling me that it's from my chemotherapy for my breast cancer. At the time that you have that original diagnosis, what you're talking about is adding chemotherapy to decrease your 20-year likelihood of cancer coming back very often, okay? And so you have a patient who has a stage 1 or stage 2 breast cancer. That patient has a real significant risk of potentially having second metastatic disease show up up to 20 years after the cancer is removed. If I give chemotherapy, I can decrease that risk by 50%. When you make that decision, you have to make that decision up front. We tell everybody at the time that they get their chemotherapy that there's about a 0.5% risk that you could develop a secondary acute myeloid leukemia. 0.5% sounds really small, but if you're the person who got that secondary acute myeloid leukemia, it happened for you 100% of the time. And so I think when we're talking to patients, we have to be clear about what the benefits are of what we're doing, and also about the potential risks. That being said, 0.5% or less is a very low likelihood of getting a secondary cancer. And if you get metastatic breast cancer, that's a pretty bad disease. So this is the sort of the calculus under which you make these decisions, knowing full well that the therapy that you give might produce a secondary problem. So how do we prevent cancers? The first thing is primary prevention, right? Don't smoke, don't eat charred meat, try to avoid the sun, wear sunblock. Avoid too much alcohol. We know that alcohol increases your risk of head and neck cancers. Try to avoid environments that are toxic. Vaccinate yourself. I think for children, I think this is increasingly important. Vaccination against HPV is likely to decrease the rates of cervical cancer and certainly decrease the rates of head and neck cancer as well, and we're starting to see that a little bit. And antibiotics to treat things like H. pylori. Important. If you clear H. pylori, the risk of gastric cancer falls off precipitously. So very important for us. That's primary prevention. That's primary care. Unfortunately, that's not what I get to do. Screening programs are very important. So how do we find these cancers early? Now, this is very feasible if you're talking about a cancer that's starting in a single location and then potentially traveling. So things like breast cancer, cervical cancer, prostate cancer maybe. A little bit unclear there. Colon cancer for sure. If you find it early and you do a surgery and you take the whole thing out before it's had a chance to travel, you could potentially cure people and prevent real mortality from their cancer, right? And this is the reason why we offer women cervical cancer screening. This is the reason we offer mammography. This is the reason we offer colonoscopy. Because those modalities have been shown to decrease the rates of metastatic cancer, of advanced cancers, by finding it early and resecting it. Once you have an established cancer that's beyond the ability to resect fully, then the options you have are treating it. And the things that you can do for treating it, you can treat it locally, if it's a locally advanced cancer. You can do surgery to take it off, that's another local therapy. Or you can give systemic therapy that treats the patient as a whole, if you believe that the disease has traveled beyond the limits of the resection area. If patients have advanced cancer that's unlikely to respond to therapy, then what you're talking about is palliation. Improving quality of life, potentially improving quantity of life if you can, but mostly making sure that people don't suffer. So unfortunately, a lot of what I do is about that. So what is a medical oncologist? A medical oncologist is a person who was crazy enough to decide after medical school and residency in internal medicine that they wanted to specialize in an area of patients who are suffering from cancer. We use chemotherapy, we use hormone therapies, we use biological therapies. We are the main health provider for patients with advanced cancers, and we provide a lot of supportive care and coordinate treatment with other specialties. What I can tell you is that once a patient has a cancer diagnosis, pretty much every other doctor says, oh, they should go to see their oncologist for that because we can't figure out what's going on. So how do you get to this point? You do 4 to 8 years in medical school. If you decided you wanted to do a PhD during medical school, it would take 8 years. The rest of us usually take 4. Following that, you do an internal medicine residency, which takes 3 years. And then you do a hematology plus or minus an oncology fellowship. These are actually 2 separate fellowships, and you have 2 separate exams for that. Most people do just oncology. Some people do both. These are 2 separate things, and you have to take 2 separate tests for it. Your fellowship can last between 3 years to 8 or 10 years, depending on how many years you like to stay in the laboratory as a postdoc and whether or not you want to do basic science. And then after that, you either get slated into one of these three things. You can go to private practice and see a lot of patients, and generally in private practice, people see a wide variety of malignancies, majority obviously driven by the most frequently driven cancers, right? So cancers of lung, cancers of the breast, cancer of the prostate. Or you can become an academic. People in academics usually will specialize in a particular area. So, for example, I am an oncologist. I'm also a hematologist. I have both of those board certifications. And I'm also internal medicine certified, so there's extra exams there. But I see in my practice patients with bone marrow failure, with myelodysplastic syndrome, with acute myeloid leukemia or acute lymphoblastic leukemia. I do not see other blood cancers in general, and I do not see any solid tumors. Okay? So I'm a very subspecialized group of this person. I'm a relatively subspecialized person. And when you talk to other oncologists here at Roswell, a majority of us are subspecialized like this. Right? So Dr. Iyer will see cancers of the GI tract, pancreas cancer, upper GI, gastric cancer, cancers of the colon, hepatic cancers. Dr. Oprakal will see breast cancer. He'll see also, he now sees melanoma and sarcoma, but that was not by choice. And then we have other physicians who are specializing in other areas of cancer, okay? And then once you subspecialize like that, you sort of get into your own niche, and many of us who do this also do a little research because that's our interest as well. And then there are a whole group of doctors who decide they want to go directly into industry or they want to do industry after the fact. And in industry, those doctors are actively involved in the development of novel therapeutics for patients with cancer. So, we don't really play a huge role in cancer prevention. We do identify predisposition syndromes, and we do retrospective analysis of large cohorts of people to try and figure out how you could prevent things, so we participate in that. We want to make sure we have increased recognition of social, occupational, nutritional, and sexual practices that contribute to neoplasia. We participate in education. We participate strongly in smoking cessation. As you know, here at Roswell, we have a large group of people whose primary focus is smoking prevention and smoking cessation. And we have also a large program in early screening and detection for early lung cancers, which has been remarkably successful and resulted in a lot of publications. We want to evaluate and screen appropriate risk populations. So we actually have a geneticist on staff here. I don't know if you, do you guys get any lectures from Nicoletta Voyen? Yes? Okay. So Dr. Voyen is a clinical geneticist. So Dr. Voyen's whole job is to make sure we identify patients who have genetic predisposition syndromes for cancer and figure out and make sure that we are appropriately screening them to prevent secondary cancers. So people with HNPCC can get a wide spectrum of different cancer diagnoses, and they need to have things like urine testing to make sure they don't have premalignant lesions in the urothelium. They need regular colonoscopy. They need regular breast cancer screening. It's a whole host of things, and that's actually quite complicated. So you need somebody who's very familiar with these cancer predisposition syndromes to help you figure that out. So cancer diagnoses require histologic proof of at least one occasion. You always want to think about cancer in a history, in a patient who has a history of prior cancer, to make sure that the cancer is not recurrent. One should never attribute symptoms to cancer, but you really have to rule them out, and cancer symptoms should always be on the differential. Cancer patients can also have other symptomatic diseases, so you don't want to just assume that it's the cancer and not investigate something else. So I always like to tell a story, because I think it's very important to put these things, I can say all this, but it's very important to put this in a real person context. So my mother's best friend showed up after a trip to Florida with abdominal distension and pain. And she went into the ER, and they did a CT scan, and they said that she had diffusely metastatic ovarian cancer in the abdomen. And she was a very smart lady, and she had fluid in the belly, and they tapped her belly, and they could not demonstrate cancer cells. And I called the oncologist who was seeing my mother's friend, and I said, you know, I appreciate that it's very classic on the CT scan, and that everything looks suspicious and that she has an elevated level of blood level for this cancer diagnosis, but you know, she's never going to accept chemotherapy until you show me cancer in the dish, okay? And this is just the reality, and I'm saying this to you. You're telling me you've never seen anything else present like except like cancer like this. This is definitely cancer. Fine. Patient, my mother's friend went to surgery to have sampling and to have diagnosis done, and she had She actually had endometriosis. Okay? And I think it's really, really important to make sure that you do not miss something that is not cancer. And I think this is, for me, I spoke to her on the phone. I spoke to a colleague of mine who is an academic oncologist who looked at this scan and told me that she has never seen anything else that looked like this that was not cancer. And she told me she would, in her opinion, we should give my mother's friend chemotherapy up front for debulking and then take her to the OR and take out the rest. And she assured me that I was being ridiculous to ask her for surgery. So every time I am absolutely sure of something, I step back and I ask myself, am I right? And this is something, anytime, I would give you this piece of advice for free. Anytime you feel yourself being absolutely sure of an answer, think twice. Especially if somebody else's life depends on your quest, on your being right. This is a single piece of advice that I would give to every person. Always question feeling right. So, chemotherapy. What do we do for chemotherapy? Chemotherapy is a very generic term, and we talk in oncology about chemotherapy very generically. So, these days, historically, chemotherapy was genotoxic drugs, right, that stopped DNA replication and that caused genetic catastrophe and induced apoptosis. In modern times, chemotherapy includes tyrosine kinase inhibitors, small molecule inhibitors of a variety of different sorts. We also include in this chemotherapy antibody therapies, things like Herceptin, Rituxan, all of these things. Historically, again, chemotherapy was a genotoxin. These days, it's not anymore. Right? So we have a lot of things that we use that are considered chemotherapy that come under the rubric of oncology that are no longer genotoxins. The oncologist, you're responsible for appropriate drug and dose combinations, and you want to make sure that you use the right kind of drugs for the cancer type, the stage, and the age, and the comorbidities. A lot of what we do is managing side effects after giving genotoxic therapy. So the principles of treatment, where is the tumor? What effect does it have on normal organ and structure and function? This is really important because in many ways, cancer these days is a little bit more like diabetes, right? Many people have diabetes. If your diabetes is uncontrolled, diabetes will kill you, right? Why will diabetes kill you? Diabetes will kill you because you get peripheral neuropathy, because you get glycosylation of the vessels in the heart, because you get end-stage renal disease, right? If you manage your diabetes, you can live with it for a long time. Cancers very often kill you because of compromise of other organ functions, right? So if I have metastatic melanoma, the metastatic melanoma lesion on my toe is not going to hurt me. But if I get metastatic melanoma in my liver and in my lungs, that'll compromise the ability of those organs to do their primary job, and that will kill me. Okay? So when we think about these cancers, we want to think about how it is that those cancers are going to kill us. We want to ask the question, how toxic is the treatment that I'm proposing to give to the surrounding tissue? So very frequently, we have patients with prostate cancer. Okay? When you have prostate cancer, the options are you can whack it out with surgery, which will leave a majority of people incontinent, or you can do radiation, which also leaves people incontinent, by the way. And you want to ask the question, is that therapy worthwhile? Will that prolong the patient's life? If you're old and you have prostate cancer, mostly you'll die with your prostate cancer rather than of it. So maybe you don't want to do any of those things, okay? If you're young and you get prostate cancer, that prostate cancer is more likely to kill you. It tends to be more aggressive. And so in that case, it's worth taking these risks. So whenever you think about doing surgery or doing any kind of therapy, you want to think about the surrounding tissues that are going to be damaged. Is the treatment that I'm offering potentially a curative approach, or is it palliative? Because if it's curative, you're much more willing to take potential side effects, potential risks, than it is if you're palliative. Because when you're talking about palliation, we're talking about extending life and extending quality of life, but you're not talking about curing a patient to give long-term treatment. So these are the laws of therapeutics. This is sort of a little bit tongue-in-cheek here, but I think bottom line, if it's working, you want to keep it up, right? You want to keep doing something that's working, especially if you have someone who's not likely to be cured. This is true for patients with myelodysplastic syndrome. So I treat people with MDS. This is a disease that we know is a disease of stem cells. The only curative approach is an allogeneic bone marrow transplant. For patients who have the disease, who have high-grade disease, one can give a drug called azacitidine. This drug works by hypomethylation, we think. When you give it once a month, okay? And you do that forever until the patient progresses or dies from some other cause, Mostly the patients progress and they die from the disease, but that's what we do. If it doesn't work, stop doing it. So if you have a patient who's getting a therapy and the therapy is not working anymore, it's very reasonable to stop that therapy and to take it away, because then you're costing somebody the cost of taking the drug plus also the potential side effects without any benefit. If you don't know what to do, don't do anything. Talk to somebody else, review the case again, re-biopsy it. I think my mother's friend is a great example of that, right? And the treatment shouldn't be worse than the disease. I think that's also important to know, right? Because if the treatment is worse than the disease, sometimes the patient will decide that they don't want to take treatment. Now, this is true a majority of the time, especially for solid tumors. It's a little less true for things like leukemia, okay? Because leukemia, what I can tell you about leukemia is that if you develop an acute leukemia, that's going to kill you within a month or two if I do nothing. And the therapies that I give are pretty rotten, put people in the hospital, but if I get them into remission, I get them through the therapy, that patient can live a relatively normal life expectancy. And so in that case, we're willing to take a little bit more side effect and a little bit more bad part to get the good part. So the principles of chemotherapy, I touched on this before, but again, if it's a localized disease, if you have something that is an epithelial-driven malignancy, skin cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, lung cancer, head and neck cancer, right? Epithelial cancers that are localized. If you can take that cancer out because it hasn't spread, then that's reasonable. That's a local therapy. So cancer surgery is generally a localized therapy. Radiation is essentially the same as surgery. Okay? Radiation will only treat the area that you radiate. So if you have a localized cancer that's slightly beyond the margins or that you think is maybe still localized to a specific region, if you radiate that area, you will kill anything that's in that region. So the best example of this is breast cancer. So if I have an early breast cancer, the options are modified radical mastectomy, in which you take the whole breast, and lymph node dissection, which can be quite toxic in the sense that people end up with lymphedema. So if you take out all of the lymph nodes, the lymph doesn't drain properly from the arm, and people can get very swollen arms, and it can be actually very uncomfortable. So the options are modified radical mastectomy with complete lymph node dissection, or breast conservation therapy. So lumpectomy, which is where you take out just the cancer itself, and then you do sentinel lymph node dissection. So you inject dye into the breast, and then you dissect the axilla to identify the first draining lymph node, and then you check that lymph node to make sure there's no evidence to suggest that there's actually micrometastatic disease that you can't see visibly. And if that's negative, then what you can do is you can take the patient and you can take them to radiation. And so people will get completion radiation to the remainder of the breast, because the hypothesis is that there's probably some micrometastatic disease left in there. And then very often they'll do radiation, if it was a higher grade tumor or something concerning, to the mammary, internal mammary lymph nodes, the supraclavicular lymph nodes, and the axilla. Okay, so you'll do a radiation port that encompasses that area. And the idea is that if there's any leftover disease that's within that radiation port, you can get rid of it. Because we know breast cancer tends to be naughty and to show up late with late metastatic disease. So surgery, radiation, we talked about that. Photodynamic therapy, big at Roswell Park, very, very effective for some early stage cancers. The idea is you take a photosensitizer and then you expose the cancer to a light, which kills specifically that cancer that's taken up the radio sensitizer. Okay? You can do specific therapies directed at mets. So we now know that patients who have colon cancer, the first place that the colon cancer, that the colon drains, is actually through the liver. The red cell, the blood cell supply for the colon, goes back through the liver and is filtered. And so the first place that colon cancers metastasize very often is to the liver. And it turns out that if you do local therapy to those mets, sometimes you can cure patients of disease for a long time, or you can certainly get the disease to progress less. And the liver is amazing in the sense that if you kill off something that's in there, it'll grow back and fill the space. And so very often we do that. And so these are things that you think about as local or regional therapies to control either early stage disease or low level metastatic disease. This is also true for people who have things like sarcoma. So if you have sarcoma tends to metastasize to the lung. And it turns out that if you have sarcoma that's with mets to the lung, if you take out the localized sarcoma and then you take out the lung mets, you can actually have patients survive much longer. So these are local regional disease. So that's one approach. And this is usually more effective for cancers that tend to be less sensitive to chemotherapy or or to targeted therapies. And then you have systemic therapy. So if you have a patient with metastatic disease, the only approach that might be effective is a whole body approach. Because at this point, the disease has spread from beyond the area that you're in, the localized area. And in this case, you want to give cytotoxic therapies or hormonal therapies. So breast cancer is a great example. If you have a patient who has metastatic disease that's ER/PR positive, you can actually treat a patient, even with widely metastatic disease, with estrogen blockers, right? If you're postmenopausal, you can get an aromatase inhibitor. If you're premenopausal, you can get tamoxifen. And that can actually dramatically reduce the disease burden. Otherwise, if you have patients who have acute leukemia, you give whole body therapy intravenously that gets to the disease in the whole body. And then you want to make sure, one of the things that we've done really well recently is the improvement in supportive care therapies. And that includes things like antiemetics, which are much better these days than they were, growth factor support to improve hematopoiesis, and narcotics to prevent pain. So more often than not, for the diseases that I treat, we give combination chemotherapies. And this was because historically we had the idea that historically single agent therapies were shown. Have you guys read the Emperor of All Maladies? Do you guys read that as part of this class or one of the classes you take? Right, so historically, right, in that book they talk about the evolution of therapeutics, right? Initially folate derivatives as single agents treating patients, babies with ALL as the first paradigm of therapies. We understand now that you can't give enough to get the cells to die, right? So you can give combinations. All right. So when we talk about treating cancers, oncologists throw around a lot of words, things like adjuvant, neoadjuvant, right? This all sounds like alphabet soup. Okay, so I'm going to try and demystify it. Okay, so neoadjuvant means before you give your primary therapy. Okay? So it's chemotherapy or radiation that you do before you take the tumor out. So for breast cancer, if you have a big breast cancer that you think you might not be able to get, that might be invading the skin or that might be invading the chest wall, if you give chemotherapy and radiation beforehand, you might be able to shrink that down, and then you might be able to do a good surgery. Or if you have colon cancer, you might be able to downstage the patient to get the tumor to shrink. So neoadjuvant allows you to shrink the tumor to allow smaller resections or organ preservation, and the response to treatment gives you an in vivo test of how effective your chemotherapy is. So for sarcomas, for example, this is a very important part of the therapy. You give one or two rounds of chemo first, you see, and then you take out the tumor and you say, did you have good killing or not? And that gives you a sense of how aggressive and bad the tumor is. And this may enhance the efficacy of radiation to avoid the need for surgery. So for head and neck cancers, for example, historically, if you had head and neck cancer, the only thing you could do was a complete laryngectomy. So people without a voice box, which is very distressing. Nowadays, for many people with head and neck cancer, you can actually do chemotherapy and radiation, cisplatin and combination radiation, with the idea of sparing those organs, so you don't have to do such a big surgery. Okay, so post-surgical chemotherapy and radiation, we call this adjuvant. So you get your surgery first, and then you give chemo after. That's the idea here. This can offer cure for some tumors where surgery alone has a low cure rate. This is true for things like Wilms tumor or osteosarcomas. And it prolongs disease-free survival for stage 2 and 3 breast cancers, stage 3 ovarian cancers, and some colon cancers, pancreas cancer of all stages, and lung cancers 1B, 2, and 3 post-surgery. So if you can take out the primary cancer and then you give systemic therapy, this improves the likelihood that you'll be without cancer long-term. Targeted therapies, now also under the rubric of chemotherapies, are medicines which block the growth of cancer cells by interfering with specific targets that are needed for carcinogenesis, rather than by genotoxic stress. They're more effective and less harmful to normal cells, and these are really the new paradigm of cancer therapeutics, right? This is where we're going. We're hoping to give magic bullets for treating cancer. Upfront chemotherapy are for chemotherapies where surgery is not appropriate with local measures or for where radiation is not appropriate, and for most solid tumors, the goal is really prolongation of survival rather than cure. So if you have metastatic lung cancer, you're gonna die of metastatic lung cancer, okay? At some point, that's gonna cause your death, because the therapies we have are not effective entirely effective. But you can prolong somebody's survival by shrinking the tumor with chemotherapy. That being said, there are a small number of cancers that are actually curative at the stage of metastatic disease. This is true for germ cell tumors. For example, Lance Armstrong is a great example. Lance Armstrong had a germ cell tumor. Germ cell tumors are notoriously sensitive to chemotherapy. If you have choriocarcinoma, which is the carcinoma you can get after you get a pregnancy that causes a problem, you can get those treated. Cancers that are treatable and or curable with chemo alone include things like ALL and lymphoma in kids, seminomas, Hodgkin lymphomas, probably Burkitt leukemias and lymphomas, promyelocytic leukemia. It's a great cancer as a paradigm. In promyelocytic leukemia, we know that the disease is driven by a mutation in translocation between chromosome 15 and 17 that results in the PML-RARA fusion protein, right? And we know the mechanism of that fusion results in a maturation arrest at the promyelocyte stage. And if you give all transretinoic acid and arsenic, you can block the activity of that fusion protein, and you can cause cure in more than 90% of patients with APL. Okay? That's a huge paradigm shift. Historically, in the 50s, there was actually an article written about the malpractice of treating patients with promyelocytic leukemia, okay? Because everybody died, and they all died because of bleeding and from the sequelae of the disease. For patients with diffuse large cell lymphoma, we're doing pretty well. About 60% of people will achieve long-term cure with chemotherapy and Rituxan. Hairy cell leukemia, a great example. If you have hairy cell leukemia, if I give you one course of 2-CDA of cladribine, these patients respond beautifully, and they stay in remission. Usually, they're cured of their disease. CML, nice paradigm. These patients, these days, we treat them with imatinib, right? And we give that imatinib or dasatinib or nilotinib, second-generation inhibitors of BCR-ABL, and those patients have a normal life expectancy, provided we have good control of their disease. And in fact, in a small percentage of patients who achieve a great degree of control, we can sometimes discontinue the imatinib therapy, and we can offer potentially cure for those patients. So some cancers are curable with combined modality surgery and chemoradiation. This includes things like non-metastatic carcinomas, early-stage lung cancers, head and neck cancers, early-stage gastric or esophageal cancers, maybe breast cancer, maybe prostate cancer, maybe some ovarian cancers, and sarcomas, some as long as they're small. So what about the rest? The bottom line is that really metastatic cancer is very rarely curable. Okay, so once you have a metastatic cancer with very specific exceptions, these patients do not survive long term. And even early cancers that are treated at an early stage sometimes have micrometastatic disease that will come back and bite the patient later. Cancers that relapse are often difficult to treat as a result of the development of resistance mutational events and resistance pathways, possibly also as a result of the fact that maybe pre-existing resistant clones have been merged as a result of therapy. So we try very high dose therapy. We try things like transplant, right, for breast cancer. The idea here was that if you autologous transplant for breast cancer, essentially what that is you think that maybe the breast cancer would be killed if you could only give just enough therapy, right? If you could only just give enough cytotoxic therapy, maybe you could get rid of the rest. So the idea was you would give people high-dose chemotherapy and give them back their own stem cells so they didn't die of infections before their hematopoiesis recovered. Unfortunately, that turned out to be a huge bust, right? So we did a whole bunch of autologous transplants for breast cancer. This was initially adopted with a lot of enthusiasm, and it turned out that it didn't work. Sometimes we try growth factors to increase the frequency with which we can give chemotherapy. So for breast cancer, again, we give dose-dense chemotherapy, so we give it quickly together, thinking that if we do that, we can get the cells that are growing back when you stop the chemotherapy. We also combine different drugs, and we know that this works, particularly for ALL. Childhood ALL, we have a 90% cure rate, and that's because of combination chemotherapies, because of the overlapping toxicity and benefit of the cancer therapeutics, which compromise the ability of those cancer cells to dry. And we're trying new drugs and drug combinations in clinical trials, and then we'll talk about clinical trials as we go forward. So how do we develop a new drug? We have an idea. You guys are going to go, and you're going to go into the lab. You're going to have fantastic ideas, right? You're going to revolutionize cancer therapeutics for me. You're going to come to me. You're going to say, Elizabeth, I have this new thing. I think I can cure cancer. How do we get it to market? How do we get it to the patient, right? Because there's a difference between treating a mouse. I mean, you need an IRB approval to treat a mouse, but it's not quite the same as treating a patient, okay? So we have a novel compound we're really excited about. We do a whole bunch of experiments in vitro. We show we can kill cancer cell lines. Cancer cell lines don't care. We can keep killing them in vitro. Nobody cares. I mean, those cancer cell lines, we don't have to ask their permission, right? We just treat them. So we start there. Now we show it in mice. We kill mice. We have to ask permission for that. We have to make sure we're treating them properly, but we can do that. And, you know, very often we have new compounds that are incredibly exciting and show really good responses in mice. And unfortunately, then we try them in humans, less exciting. But we can do that without asking anybody, right? We can go to the lab, we can do that. So then, once I have a compound, and you've treated it in the vitro, you've treated it in mice, then I have to get it to patients. So the very first thing you have to ask The very first thing you have to do is you have to get it in a formulation that I can give to the patient. Because it's all very well for you to treat with bleach. Bleach kills cancer cells in vitro. Bleach, if you inject it into a tumor in a mouse, will kill the mouse and the tumor. But if you try to give that to a patient, it's very challenging because we get very upset when we kill off the patient. So you have to come up with a production and formulation. You have to give me enough so that I can do a clinical trial, right? If I'm proposing to give it to 8 or 10 or 20 people, I have to have enough of it, right? These are things you don't think about initially. You have to have evidence of toxicology. So you have to show me that if I give it to mice, if I give it to rats, if I give it to monkeys, that it's not too toxic. You have to prove to me that it's reasonably safe to give to patients. Patients with bad cancer, you can often get away with more toxic things, but still, things that kill 50% of the monkeys, those don't fly, okay? And then we start with a phase one clinical trial. In a phase one clinical trial, we ask the question, is it safe? Okay, the fundamental, this is very important and interesting to me, okay? The fundamental importance of phase one clinical trial, the one thing that you're interested in, safety. Phase one clinical trials are about safety. Now, it turns out that clinical trials in general are very expensive, okay? And these days, if you have a drug and you test it in a phase one trial, you want to have some information about efficacy as well. Because many things that are safe have no efficacy. And if you're a big drug company, you don't want to waste your money. So you have to have some evidence of efficacy. Phase two clinical trials are about response. Phase three clinical trials are about proving that this treatment, this new treatment, is better than the standard of care. And then phase four clinical trials are about making sure that you understand the toxicity of your product in a general use situation. Okay? All right, so we're going to drill down on this. Development of anti-cancer compounds. How do we do this? Initially, the NCI 60 in 1955 was developed to identify things that would kill cancer cells in vitro. So they have a panel of cancer cells. You test them again. You test your new compound against this panel of cancer cell lines, and you show that it can kill the cancer cell lines. The paradigm for this is Taxol, right? Taxol is a natural product derived from the Pacific yew tree, and this blocks the activity of microtubules, right? And if you give it to cancer cells in general, this will kill cancer cells in vitro. Identification was based on efficacy, and the mechanism was interrogated after the fact, right? So historically, things that kill, you can test them in vitro, you do this. And then once we understood that it worked, and once we understood its mechanism, we could develop analogs and synthesize the compound. So we didn't have to go whacking down Pacific yew trees or stealing their needles. So in modern times, drug development is often based on the idea of rational drug design. So we identify a target. We say we have a patient, we have this BCR-ABL thing. Okay, so we know BCR-ABL is the sine qua non of the disease chronic myelogenous leukemia. We see that patients with chronic myelogenous leukemia, right now the standard of care is a drug called interferon, which causes people to feel like they want to kill themselves, literally. And if you're young, you can get an allotransplant. Allotransplant works, for sure, but 10% of my patients who go to allotransplant will die from the transplant, and then you're left with the problem of graft-versus-host disease. Okay, so we know we have a sine qua non of a tumor. We know the therapies are shit. So now we want to see if we block the function of this thing, how do we stop it? Does it work? So imatinib was developed as modern drug design. So they said, okay, we have this target. How do we fit a protein into that pocket? How do we block that pocket? And that's the idea of modern drug design. So nowadays you find something like BRAF mutations in melanoma, and then you say, what compounds do I have in my library that bind this compound? It's a little bit different than just saying we want to find nonspecific killing things. So initially, if you have something that you think is a cytotoxin, you can assess it using the NCI drug screen. In this way, you incubate your compound in vitro with three different tumor cell lines at a single concentration for 48 hours, and you ask if there's any activity at all. And if there's any killing, you screen against 60 human tumor cell lines at five different doses for 48 hours. And then if it looks promising, like you've killed a fair number of things or the same kind of thing, then you can do this hollow fiber technique where you have 12 target tumor cell lines that grow in a hollow fiber, and you try to run your drug through them and see if you can open up that hollow fiber. And then, if that looks promising, then you can go to in vivo testing using xenografts, right? And these can either be sort of primary human tumor xenografts, or you can use cell line xenografts. And you can treat the mouse for different compounds for an extended period of time. So by contrast, again, rational drug design is the idea that you identify a target, and then you use high-throughput screening of chemical libraries to identify molecules that bind to the target. And this is how they identified this compound, 2-phenylaminopyrimidine. pyrimidine, and then they developed, this was a compound that actually was incredibly insoluble, and so they modified it just a little bit to make it soluble, so you could give it as a pill. And you got imatinib, and then you did preclinical testing in animal models and against human cell lines, and then you demonstrate using clinical trials that this is an effective compound. So in terms of formulation and toxicology, it's important to identify drug metabolism, because it turns out that many compounds, once you take them as a human being, they get modified by the liver. You can add a variety of different things to those compounds in order to improve excretion of those compounds, and those secondary metabolites actually can turn out to be very active, or even more active than the primary compound. So that's very important. Many small molecules actually are extensively protein-bound, so many of the tyrosine kinase inhibitors that we use to treat patients with FLT3-positive acute myeloid leukemia, initially there were a whole bunch of clinical studies in AML using FLT3 inhibitors that turned out not to be efficacious. And part of the reason for that was it turned out that many of those tyrosine kinase inhibitors were bound to protein in circulation, and so were never actually hitting the target. And so there are many things that are, if you don't really understand the pharmacokinetics of these drugs, that you would throw out that maybe have significant efficacy because you don't understand the pharmacokinetics. And then you also have to worry about absorption. So there are a lot of drugs that if you give them by mouth, they're going to actually be inhibited or they won't be properly absorbed. And so in that context, you're never going to hit the target either. And then you have to decide whether or not you can give something by mouth or if you have to give it intravenously or subcutaneously. And then you want to show toxicology, as I said before, in at least two animal species. The majority of the time this is mouse or rat and monkey. And then you want to have a plan for a large-scale production. So once you have this preliminary toxicology study, you've done this work before, you've got your drug, you know how to make it, you can prove that you can make it, then you want to produce, you want to get the FDA to say it's okay for you to start testing this. So how do you do that? So you submit something called an investigational new drug application to the FDA. This can be done by the investigator personally, either in an emergency situation or in a treatment situation. So an investigator-sponsored or a company-sponsored investigational new drug application can be submitted for a clinical trial. This proposes studying either an unapproved drug, so a brand new thing that you've come up with in the lab, or a new combination of drugs. So I'm in the process of putting together a grant to study the drug azacitidine, which is FDA approved for the treatment of patients with MDS, in combination with the drug I was talking about before, interferon. Now, this combination has previously been studied in melanoma, and it's been previously studied in some other contexts, but it's never been studied in MDS. And so in order to do that in patients, I have to submit an investigational new drug application to the FDA and get approval for that. So this is also true if you have an approved drug like I have in a new indication. So an emergency use IND lets the FDA authorize an experimental drug in an emergency situation. So very frequently, I have patients who have progressed on all standard therapy. And I have drugs that I think are likely to work or that have been shown in phase 2 or even phase 3 clinical trials which are not yet FDA approved. And in this context, I can write a letter to the FDA, I can submit a single use emergency IND, and I can get approval from the FDA via the local IRB to treat my patient with this drug on an emergency situation, on a single patient basis. And a treatment IND is submitted for an experimental drug showing promise in a clinical testing for serious or immediate life-threatening conditions while the final clinical work is conducted. So these are sort of overlapping. In my experience, mostly these are overlapping. So these can be submitted, again, as I said before, by commercial or research entities. They have to contain information on animal studies, pharmacology and toxicology. They include information about manufacturing, and they include a clinical protocol and investigator information. So you have to have the CV of the investigator that says this is a person who's competent to ask for this process, who has the background, who has the experience, and you have to include information about how you're going to treat that patient. So I'm going to get this drug to treat this patient in an emergency way. I'm going to treat them according to this particular way that's been presented before. This is how I'm going to assess how they respond, and this is what I'm going to do if they don't respond. If you have a clinical protocol that's testing something in a bigger sense, then you have to say this is how we're going to treat these patients. All the patients are going to be treated the same way. This is how we're going to assess the response, and you have to prove to the FDA that this is a rational approach. Once it's submitted, the sponsor has to wait 30 days, in general, before initiating any clinical trials. This is not true for an emergency use or an individual IND. In those cases, the FDA will get back to you usually within a very short period of time, sometimes within a 1 or 2 day turnaround. So clinical trials can be designed by an independent investigator, by a pharmaceutical company, can also be designed by a cooperative group. So in the United States, we have the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, we have the Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology, we also have the Children's Oncology Group. These are large groups that get together and say, what's the next big trial we're going to do in this disease? And then we all collaborate together to put patients on. This is especially important for relatively rare diseases, where you have relatively few patients at each small institution. And this is also important for things like pediatric cancers, where you have very small numbers nationwide. So clinical protocols are designed to ensure uniformity and reproducibility of procedures and research design. So if I want to study our new compound, for example, in a phase one study, mostly those can happen in a single institution. So that's me and my partners. We're all treating the same kind of cancers. We all have very similar approaches to our patients. We write a clinical trial. We all agree about what that clinical trial is going to do for these patients and how we're going to assess those patients. And then we write this clinical trial, and it helps us to know, what am I going to do? Because if I'm treating a patient and they have an adverse event, do I hold the drug? Do I dose decrease the drug? How do I deal with that? And in order to be sure that the way you're treating the patient is going to answer the question you're going to ask, just the same way as the way you treat mice in the lab, you have to have a standard approach, right? Because if I don't do it in a standard way, how do I know that the other things I did didn't give me the answer I want? In humans, that's quite challenging, but the best way we have to do it is to write a standard clinical protocol. This is even more important if I have a multi-institution trial, where I have many, many different groups of people whose standard of care approach might be a little bit different at each place. All the personnel who participate in a clinical trial have to have this written protocol that specifies the treatment, the inclusion criteria, the stopping parameters, and you have to have everybody familiar with what to do. So in a protocol, we cover all these myriad of topics. I think the bottom line here is this is a recipe book, and you want to have the recipe book be as clear and as straightforward as possible that tells people, why am I doing this combination? What's the rationale for this approach? What are the drugs I'm using in this combination? How am I going to treat the patients? Which patients can be included? Inclusion and exclusion criteria, who do I not want to include? What things would stop me from putting them on this test, right? If they have other cancers, for example, that might make you concerned that the other cancer might drive their mortality, and then you wouldn't be able to assess your disease. You wouldn't be able to assess your response. If I have side effects, how do I deal with those? You want to have all of that information in your protocol. And you also want to have a plan for your correlative science in the protocol. Many times we're looking to see, did we hit the target? Do we have protein binding? What are we getting? What are the drug levels, the PKs, for example, in an early phase clinical trial? And then when do I take people off protocol? When do I say that this is too toxic? How do I make a decision? At what point in the study do I decide to continue or to stop? So these are all important. And then in addition, you want to have a consent form in there that you give to patients to explain what exactly you're doing, why are you doing it, how are they going to benefit or not, and what they can expect in terms of protocol things that are not standard of care, so people understand what they're doing. So in a phase one trial, we're interested in toxicology. We want to submit an IND application and get approval. We go ahead to our phase one study. The patients are often refractory or pretreated. They may have many different cancer subtypes historically. This is a little bit less true these days. Even most phase one trials, we have a preliminary idea, especially if it's a targeted therapy, right? We know that patients with this mutation are more likely to respond to this inhibitor. In our phase one, we want to select those patients. It gives us the best chance of having a good response early that takes us to the next generation clinical trial. The overall goal of these trials, phase one, is toxicity, right? Safety. Again, very interesting topic here, safety in a clinical trial, phase one. And dose-limiting toxicity is irreversible grade 3 or any grade 4. So grade 3 means some kind of end organ damage or elevation in a laboratory value that's beyond a certain threshold. And grade 4 is worse. Grade 5 means the patient died. Historically, we're trying to identify the maximum tolerated dose of compounds. But it turns out that a lot of things that we now use clinically, things like rituximab, for example, or other antibody therapies or small molecules, they're not going to have a maximum tolerated dose. And so what matters much more is the ability of the drug that you're giving at the dose you're giving it to hit the target. And so many clinical trials these days are actually looking for specific target direction as opposed to maximum tolerated doses, although we still have some sort of traditional chemotherapeutics that use maximum tolerated dose as the goal. We usually start this treatment at a dose that's 10% of the lethal dose 50 in the most sensitive non-human species. And again, this is sometimes somewhat problematic because you don't see any, right? If you have no toxicity in your animal model, then the question is, at what dose do you start? And then the answer is you want to start relatively low and then titrate up quickly. And so there are new clinical trial designs that allow you to really quickly dose escalate till you start hitting the target. These patients are usually treated in cohorts of 3 to 6 people. So there's a classical 3 plus 3 dose escalation design. So you treat 3 people with the drug at the particular dose, and you ask the question, do I see toxicity? If you see no toxicity, then you can move potentially to the next dose level. If you see any toxicity, then you expand that cohort to 6 patients, so another 3 patients. And you ask, did I see any more toxicity? If no toxicity in the 6, only 1 patient had toxicity and the other 5 didn't, then you expand to the next dose cohort. Okay, so that's the classical 3x3 dose escalation. And the medication dose historically was escalated using a modified Fibonacci sequence where you initially increased by 100% the dose, and then by 67, then 50, 40, et cetera. In theory, lack of response shouldn't really block further drug development, although in practice this is often the case because of issues of cost. Nowadays people are expecting a lot more from their phase 1 trial, and as a result many people combine phase 1 and phase 2 studies, okay, to decrease cost. A phase 1b trial is trying to address this issue. It's sort of saying, okay, we think we have a compound we think is going to be active. We think that this is going to be active in a particular type of cancer. Lets you address a little bit more carefully pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics and give you a better feeling for the phase 2 dose that's going to be used. Sometimes you'll do biopsies of the tumor to show that you're hitting the target or to show that you're doing what you want to do, and it helps you to further assess tolerability at the selected dose, and this way you can sort of limit to certain tumor types to preview efficacy. A phase 2 trial is used to identify response. So you have a particular patient population. So before we were talking about all sorts of patients with different types of cancer in theory. Now we're talking about specific patients with specific types of cancer at a specific stage of treatment. So phase 2 studies can sometimes be done up front if you have diseases for which outcome is relatively poor with standard therapy, or they can be done relatively late stage after the patient has failed 1, 2, 3 or more chemotherapy regimens. These patients shouldn't be particularly heavily pretreated, and no response in a patient cohort of 14 suggests ineffectiveness of your drug. If you see more than one response, then the trial can be expanded up to 30 patients. Effective drugs can be falsely rejected, unfortunately, due to incorrect dose or route and heavy prior exposure or poor patient performance status. So if you have people who are really, really sick, you might miss a response. Phase 3 trials are designed to assess activity and toxicity relative to the current standard of care. So in this case, if you have a drug, for example, in CML, the IRIS trial randomized patients to receive either imatinib or interferon as first-line therapy for CML. And they compared directly the response rate in terms of molecular response, in terms of cytogenetic response, and hematologic response to the imatinib compared with the interferon. And this requires that the doctor who's treating the patients feel as though both treatments are equally likely to result in a response. So as a doctor, you have to feel comfortable that this is the standard of care. The size of the trial is based on the expected difference in endpoints between the new treatment and the standard of care, and this gives you something called the power calculation. Power calculations are very interesting. Power is the number of patients you need to show the statistically significant difference between the standard of care, current standard of care, and the new therapy. If you have two therapies that have relatively similar response rates, you might want to show a difference not in standard of care, not in response, but instead in toxicity. And again, if you expect a distinction between the toxicity of two regimens with similar efficacy, you can use that as the basis for your power calculation. Okay? A phase 4 study essentially means that the patient, the drug has been approved by the FDA, and you're now doing market analysis to generate increased information about relatively rare events in a large patient population. So again, phase 1 establishes toxicity and dose schedule. Phase 2 identifies promising therapies. Phase 3 is important to identify the effective treatment relative to the natural history of disease for those diseases that don't have a current standard. So if I have a disease for which there's really nothing, and I try a new drug, and I show that the new drug results in improvement in patients' symptoms, standard of quality of life, life expectancy, great. If I have an old drug that's working okay, but now I have a new drug that works much better, I can compare those two. Or if I have a drug that's relatively toxic and I want to try a new therapy, like for example, interferon worked okay, it didn't work all the time, but it did work okay, but it was incredibly toxic, caused people to feel suicidal, and didn't work all the time. Now I compared it to imatinib. Imatinib caused a little bit of swelling in the ankles, a little bit of oral swelling around the eyes. People sometimes got some pancreatitis, but otherwise they did great. They lived normal life expectancy. That's really important. So once a drug has proven efficacy, you submit a new drug application to the FDA to get FDA approval, and this includes a packet of information that's very comprehensive. It includes all the preclinical studies that you did, all the animal data, and all of your clinical data from the clinical trials that you've done. And this this develops the package insert and includes information about how you're going to manufacture and quality control your drug, and that you have the capacity to do these things. There's a distinct process for a biological license application, which is for monoclonal antibodies and cytokines. This is that whole process by which we're getting things like biosimilars to market, things that are known to be efficacious, that have a known protein sequence, and new companies are wanting to make analogs of those drugs in order to compete in the marketplace. Things like G-CSF, for example, now have availability of biosimilars that are essentially molecularly identical to the primary parent compound with some small differences. This is also true for non-vaccine therapeutic immunotherapies. So once you have a new drug submitted, the FDA makes a decision about whether or not there's really a clinical benefit for the drug. And this can be data from phase two or phase three. This is usually data from phase three, or phase two trials of specific indications. Taxol was approved for use in advanced ovarian cancer and all these other agents, but not for lung cancer, but it's also used in this. So once I have a drug that's approved, as a doctor, I can write it for anybody, right? There's no problem for me writing whatever I want. Part of the problem for many expensive drugs is that you have to get insurances to approve them, right? So for example, we use the drug sorafenib, which is approved by the FDA for patients with kidney cancer and for patients with hepatocellular cancer, but is also a very effective FLT3 inhibitor. So we use it very frequently in people who are not protocol eligible to give a FLT3 inhibitor because there are currently no FDA-approved FLT3 inhibitors on the market. Probably this year, the drug midostaurin will come to market and will become FDA-approved as a FLT3 inhibitor, but at the moment, there's nothing. So we use this drug sorafenib in our patients who are FLT3 mutant with AML as an adjunct to chemotherapy, and for patients who relapse with FLT3 positive disease, off-label. And this is true across many different diseases where there's clear clinical evidence, but the company doesn't want to go back and get approval from the FDA for that indication because it costs a lot of money and it's a lot of work. So the FDA determines efficacy based on response rates and survival, but can also be based on quality of life measures. Gemcitabine, for example, was approved in pancreas cancer for improvements in quality of life. So once a drug is approved by the FDA, it can be used again outside of its approved indication, like we talked about, and insurers will usually reimburse for drugs that are used outside of the labeled indication as long as you have good phase 2 data. So in patients with FLT3 mutant AML, we have really great data to show incredible efficacy in combination with a variety of different cytotoxics, and so many insurance companies will cover it. Even though it costs $5,000 a month, they say it's worth it because we have clear data to show it's working. So there's a considerable difference between the development of cytotoxics versus target inhibitors. I'm sorry, my beeper is going off and it's distracting me. I'm just going to have to check to make sure that nothing is disastrous happening. Okay, no, nothing. Okay, so with cytotoxics, we're talking about brute force screening of thousands of molecules. We're looking at the ability to kill cancer cells with less toxicity compared to normal cells. In the phase 1 development of these compounds, we're looking for maximum tolerated doses, right, because this is genotoxins we're talking about here. And then the phase 2 to 4s are similar to what I talked about I described before. In this case, the mechanism of action is usually inhibition of cellular pathways and often effective for multiple different kinds of cancer, and the toxicity is any rapidly dividing cell, right? So if I give you cytarabine is an analog of the DNA building block cytidine. If I give you cytarabine at high dose, it'll kill anything that's growing quickly, right? Because it's a chain terminator. And so you can expect the toxicity, hair loss, mucositis, rashes, this kind of thing. By contrast, if I have a targeted inhibitor, like, for example, imatinib, Imatinib is based on rational drug design with a specific target in mind, and you use high-throughput screening for small molecules that hit the target. In the phase one, you want to identify the biologically effective dose. So you want to find out at what dose does the drug that I'm giving hit the target that I'm interested in. And then they're similar across phase two and four studies. In this case, the mechanism is known in advance, and we know the specific target. And so we can expand the applicability of this drug to other targets that have similar shapes, right? Interestingly, the toxicities are often idiosyncratic and often less severe, and so you don't end up with maximum tolerated doses in this context. I can tell you that if you give imatinib to patients at higher dose, what you get is swelling, and you also get increased risk of bleeding, and you get pancreatitis, and you get pleural effusions, and you can get a lot of nausea and vomiting, and you can get increased decreased GI transit time, so people get diarrhea. But it's not the same as if I give too much chemotherapy and I cause everybody to drop their blood counts, right? A little different. So that is the last slide in this thing. At this time, I would be happy to take any questions that you have. Hopefully, I have been reasonably salient to the topics at hand, and you guys have come away with some ideas of what might be on the exam coming up in the future. Don't all scream once. Yes? No, in this case, I feel as though the drug names are examples. I think it's worthwhile to consider the paradigm of drug development. So when you think about cytotoxics versus targeted therapeutics, I think having that kind of paradigm in mind and understanding the distinctions between the two different drug development paradigms would be useful and is very important for you guys in terms of your future careers. Just as a general comment. No other questions? All right.